Moses. Moses did not marry a Negress or an Edomite. While I've never written an article specifically on Zipporah, the wife of Moses, I did discuss her at length in my June 2013 commentary on Acts chapter 7, so that would be the basis for this conversation. It's derived from that. I've made more than a few changes. Here we shall briefly discuss the true identity of the wife of Moses. The common perception in the mainstream churches is that Moses had married a Negress, because in one verse in the book of Numbers, it says that his wife was an Ethiopian. But this view is based upon a childish ignorance of scripture and history. Simply because there is a land called Ethiopia today, over 3,500 years later, which is inhabited by Negroes. The verse is found in Numbers chapter 12, verse 1. And Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married. For he married an Ethiopian woman. Subsequently, they were punished for that by Yahweh. So they must have been wrong. They must have been wrong for chastising Moses. So what Moses did must have been in agreement with the law. Like Ruth, this is just another case of identifying someone by geography rather than by their tribe. The word Ethiopian here is from Cushith, a form of the word for Cush, which is Cushite. Yet without getting into the history of Ethiopia in Africa, which is wholly unnecessary in this context, here we will state that it is clear through the lens of the New Testament, esteeming the words of Stephen in Acts chapter 7, that these early Christians, who were indeed Hebrews, understood that Moses' wife came from the regions east of the land of Canaan, where the land of Madian, which is the Old Testament land of Midian, was located. So in Acts chapter 7, verse 29, Stephen is recorded as having said, "Then fled Moses at the saying, and was a stranger in the land of Madian, where he begot two sons." Genesis chapter 25 explains the origin of Midian. "Then again, Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah. And she bare him Zimran, and Jokshan, and Medan, and Midian, and Ishbak, and Shuah. And Jokshan begot Sheba and Dedan. And the sons of Dedan were Asherim, and Letushim, and Leumim. And the sons of Midian, Ephah, and Epher, and Hanok, and Abida, and Eldah. All these were the children of Keturah. And Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac, but under the sons of the concubines, which Abraham had. Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac his son, while he yet lived, eastward into the east country. Midian was therefore a son of Abraham." Exodus chapter 2 tells us precisely to where Moses had fled and where he had obtained his wife. Less than 400 years after Abraham sent his son Midian off to the east country, where we read, "Now when Pharaoh heard this thing," Moses' killing of the Egyptian, "he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father," who is also called Jethro in various places, "he said, 'How is it that ye are come so soon today?' And they said, 'An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds. and also drew water enough for us, and watered the flock. And he said unto his daughters, And where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter. It is clear from Acts chapter 7 and Numbers chapter 10 that Zipporah was a Midianite from the land of Midian, which was to the east of Palestine, as Abraham sent his sons to the east. We also see in Genesis chapter 37 that it was Midianites who had rescued Joseph from the pit and sold him into slavery, whereby he ended up in Egypt. By this account, it may be evident that Midianites commonly traversed the land of Canaan. Further on, in Numbers chapter 10, the name Reuel is spelled Raguel in the King James Version, as it is throughout the Septuagint. So the King James Version is not very consistent in the way that it renders names. It never is. In many places, it's terrible. It causes confusion. But we read in Numbers chapter 10, verse 29, And Moses said unto Hobab, the son of Raguel the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, We are journeying unto the place of which Yahweh said, I will give it to you. Come thou with us, and we will do thee for good. For Yahweh has spoken good concerning Israel. Here in Numbers chapter 10, verse 29, Raguel, or Reuel, as the name appears in Exodus 2:18, is perceived to be a pious man. In Numbers chapter 3, verse 1, Moses' father-in-law is called the priest of Midian. And the Midianites were the children of Abraham through the concubine Keturah. Since Moses is only five generations from Abraham, as it is recorded in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, it is likely that Raguel is only four generations removed from Abraham, since Isaac was already at least 37 years of age and probably even older when Midian was born to Keturah in Genesis chapter 25. But Isaac didn't have Jacob until he was 60. Isaac was 37 when Sarah had died because she died at the age of 127 years. And had Isaac at the age of 90. It is very clear throughout the entire biblical narrative, from Genesis through the book of Judges, Kings, and Chronicles, that the land of Midian was to the east of Palestine and not very far from it, because the children of Israel had recorded their interactions with Midianites in those very regions all throughout those scriptures. We cannot simply assume, however, that the statement in Numbers chapter 12, verse 1, calling Zipporah an Ethiopian, is wrong, nor can we assume that it necessarily contradicts all of these other scriptures. Rather, we must be able to explain from a historical perspective just how she may have been considered an Ethiopian, while all of those other scriptures that explain that she was a Midianite are certainly also valid. As we have explained at length with many historical citations in part 15 of our Genesis commentary, titled The Hamites. In the earliest Greek writings, there were two lands called Ethiopia. One was to the far south of Egypt. And while it was mentioned by them, it was scarcely known to the most ancient Greeks. Another was the Ethiopia of the East, as Herodotus had called it. And it was east of Syria and the Euphrates River. One famous ancient character who came from there was Memnon, called Memnon the Ethiopian by the Greek epic poets, who was credited with having fought as an ally of the Trojans, and also with having been the legendary founder of Susa, which was later the capital city of the Persians, just east of Mesopotamia in modern Iran. Historical inspection would lead one to realize that this Ethiopia of the East must have been a part of that entity which modern academics call the Akkadian Empire. The Ethiopia of the south was called Cush by the Hebrews. And in the early scriptures, the Hebrew name Cush first appears in Genesis chapter 2, relating to the four rivers which sprang from the original location of the Garden of Eden. There, in Genesis chapter 13, the Gihon River is said to compass the whole land of Ethiopia. Now, while the identity of all four of those rivers is contested today, two others are identifiable. The Hiddekel, which is believed to be the Tigris, since it goeth toward the east of Assyria, and the Euphrates, which the Hebrews called the Parath in Genesis chapter 2 and throughout Scripture. The fourth seems to have been the Kuwait River, which emptied at the same spot, near the same spot as these other three rivers as it crossed northern Arabia, but that river is dried up today, and it only exists in satellite imagery and geographical, or I should say geological studies of Arabia. Therefore, it is fully evident that the Hebrews had a land which they called Cush in the east, as the Greeks referred to an Ethiopia in the east. The Hebrews had identified a land which they called Cush in the east. And it only makes sense that the origins of such a Cush must be that empire of Nimrod in Mesopotamia, since he was the son of Cush, Genesis chapter 10, verse 8. The empire of Nimrod was the early stage of the Akkadian Empire, and its borders stretched to the land of Canaan. For that same reason, in Genesis chapter 14, the kings of Persia and Mesopotamia had an interest in Sodom and the cities of the plain, which were located on the coasts of the Dead Sea. Therefore, the land of Midian at the time of Moses would have also been a part of that land of Cush, and Moses' wife Zipporah could be called a Cushite or Ethiopian by geography, as well as a Midianite, which was the name of her tribe. She was certainly not a Negress, since she was also a descendant of Abraham. Very recently, another man contended with me in social media, and he was insisting that the wife of Moses must have been an Edomite, since there was a Reuel who was the son of Esau in Genesis chapter 36. However, many of the names of the patriarchs or of notable sons of Jacob were also used in the lines of Cain and Esau, such as Enoch, Lamech, and Korah. Well, I informed him that there was very likely a difference of a couple of generations between Reuel, the son of Esau, and Reuel, or Raguel, as the same Hebrew word is sometimes spelled in the King James Version. And that in Numbers chapter 10, the same man who was the father-in-law of Moses was explicitly called a Midianite. He dismissed the answer with scoffing, and he blocked me. As we have shown in the book of Acts, there the wife of Moses is also described as a Midianite. She is never described as a Negress or as an Edomite anywhere in Scripture. But it seems that people who have an agenda would insist that Yahweh God is a hypocrite, who would allow his prophets to repeatedly transgress his laws and never call them to account. But instead, they themselves are hypocrites, imagining that God would violate his law, a law which he himself even came to die in order to uphold. I have one more subject tonight, and it might be a little longer than this one, That is the location of the Exodus. And it's really simple to prove from Scripture where the Exodus must have happened, and a little bit of history. You have to know about the structure called the Prince's Wall. Some years ago, Clifton had addressed the heresies of a man named Ron Wyatt. And even many identity Christians were enamored with the pretense of this man, who made many claims of quite fantastic discoveries, none of which are actually proven to be true. Not one. But Wyatt is not the only presumed Christian who misplaces the location of the Exodus. Here we shall attempt to provide proof of the proper location, at least within reason, where the event must have taken place. The site which Wyatt and the others have claimed for the Exodus crossing of the Red Sea, near the Gulf of Aqaba, and the identification of Mount Sinai with Jabal al-Lahz in Saudi Arabia, is an unlikely and even impossible circumstance. It is highly probable, given the situation in Egypt, that the location of a structure known as the Prince's Wall is the reason why Israel could not leave Egypt by land and could not have reached the Gulf of Aqaba except by sea. And the original location of Israel in Egypt having been in the land of Goshen in the area of the Nile Delta, that the Exodus crossing of the Red Sea must have happened at the Gulf of Suez, without a doubt. From their point of departure in Ramses, and Ramses has been located by archaeologists, it's now called Pi Ramses, Pi-Ramses, and that's the point of departure of the Israelites according to the book of Exodus. So from their point of departure in Ramses, the narrative in Scripture does not leave much time for Israel to travel very far past the point of the crossing, as it is only a short time, perhaps only weeks, before the law is received at Sinai. Furthermore, while in Roman times the term Arabia was used of a wider area than it is today, or in ancient times, or in very ancient times, the term Sinai was never used as a general term for a wide area. The label Sinai was never extended beyond the peninsula between the gulfs of Suez and Aqaba. Moses was not stupid, and many of today's unlearned theories indirectly insist that the ancients were generally stupid, or at least uninformed. The term Arabia does not even appear in Scripture until the time of Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 10, and it referred to places east of Judah, but not to the south. Only later, and also in the time of the Roman Empire, was the Sinai considered a part of Arabia. So Paul identified it in that manner in Galatians chapter 4. When Moses fled to Egypt, 40 years before the Exodus, he spent 40 years in the land of Cush, because portions of what later became known as Arabia were under the marginal control of the Akkadian Empire, founded by Nimrod, the son of Cush. Moses, having spent that much time in Cush, certainly knew where he was when he wrote Sinai over and over again, as it appears 31 times in his writings. The structure known as the Prince's Wall is known from the Tale of Sinuhe, a semi-mythical Egyptian story which dates to the time of Abraham, and from other sources, such as the Greek historian Diodorus Siculus, Library of History, Book 1, Chapter 57. It was a fortified wall that controlled access into and out of Egypt from Asia. And it was built along the eastern side of the Nile Delta, running from Pelusium by the Mediterranean Sea to Heliopolis in the south. The length of the wall, which D-Dorse attests, is consistent with its having run southward to Suez and then turning west to Heliopolis. The word Shur means wall in Hebrew, and the area east of the wall was considered the wilderness of Shur, which is mentioned 6 times in Scripture. In some contexts, it might appear that Shur was also the name of the town in the same area, the name of a town in the same area. For these reasons, which I have outlined above, we may see that Exodus chapter 15, verse 22, helps put together the location of the Exodus and the crossing of the Red Sea as being across the Gulf of Suez and into the Sinai Peninsula. There we read, "So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water." With this, it is evident that when the children of Israel emerged from the crossing of the Red Sea, they immediately found themselves in the wilderness of Shur. It is mentioned several times in Scripture that Shur is before Egypt from the perspective of Palestine, such as we read in 1 Samuel chapter 27, verse 8, in part, where it mentions those nations were of old the inhabitants of the land. "As thou goest to Shur, even unto the land of Egypt," and earlier in 1 Samuel chapter 15, "and Saul smote the Amalekites from Havilah until thou comest to Shur," that is, over against Egypt. Shur was the area immediately before Egypt and would have been adjacent to the Prince's Wall, for which reason the place was named after a word meaning wall, where we read in Exodus chapter 15, verse 22, that the Israelites found no water there. That was also a complaint about the exact same area, which is found in the Tale of Sinuhi, which was written 5 centuries earlier. After the destruction of the firstborn of Egypt on the night of the Passover, the Israelites left Egypt in a short time, traveling from Ramses in the northeast portion of the Delta to Sukkoth, east of the Delta, close to the northern tip of Suez, which is evident in Exodus chapter 12, verse 37. Exodus chapter 12, verse 40 marks the 430 years from the call of Abraham to the giving of the law, which Paul had mentioned in Galatians chapter 3. Exodus chapter 12, verse 36. "And Yahweh gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they lent unto them such things as they required, and they spoiled the Egyptians." Continuing to read, verse 37. "And the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Sukkoth, about 600,000 on foot that were men besides children. And a mixed multitude went up also with them, and flocks and herds, even very much cattle. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they brought forth out of Egypt, for it was not yet leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt, and could not tarry, neither had they prepared for themselves any victual," any other food. Now the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. That was verse 40. We will read 2 more verses. "And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day it came to pass, that all the host of Yahweh went out from the land of Egypt. It is a night to be much observed unto Yahweh for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is that night of Yahweh to be observed of all the children of Israel in their generations." And of course, that would be the Passover night. after the evening in which they killed the lamb, and they took until about midnight to cook it. From Sukkoth, the Israelites went to Etham and camped on the edge of the wilderness, as it is described in Exodus chapter 13, verse 20. If the prince's wall ran from Pelusium to Heliopolis, as Didor Siculus had attested, then that wilderness would have been on the southeast side of Heliopolis, as the Israelites would never have gotten through the wall. And that is what necessitated the crossing by sea. This is only the second day of their traveling, and they could not have gotten more than 50 or 60 miles after 2 days. Even that is a generous estimate for such a large group of men, women, and children, which must have also included many elderly persons. It is about 68 miles as the crow flies from the ancient site of Heliopolis to the northern coast of the Gulf of Suez. This must be somewhere west-southwest of the Great Bitter Lake, which is north of Suez, as it is described as being between Migdol and the sea, the Red Sea, in Exodus chapter 14, verse 2. There we read, "Speak unto the children of Israel, that they turn and encamp before Pi-hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, over against Baal-zephon. Before it shall ye encamp by the sea." Before it shall ye encamp by the sea. "For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are entangled in a land. The wilderness has shut them in." They were entangled in the land because they could not travel east by land, since the prince's wall also had them blocked off. So that day when the Egyptians decided to pursue the Israelites, they overtook them encamping by the sea, in Exodus chapter 14, verse 9. This would have been only 3 days' travel, at most, for the Israelites. And therefore, they could not have been more than 90 miles from Ramses, or from Heliopolis. Therefore, the crossing must have happened near the northern portion of the Gulf of Suez, and they must have crossed into the Sinai Peninsula, which is the location of Sinai, with the wilderness of Shur immediately on the left, and very close to the points where the Israelites must have emerged from the sea. If they had crossed the main body of the Red Sea, they'd have ended up in Arabia rather than in Sinai. If you look at the map, I will provide a map at the end of this presentation, at the end of the written presentation, when I post this presentation, this podcast at Christogenia later this evening. Oh, maybe it's night by now, I guess. I'm kidding. This is not meant to be precisely full commentary on the subject, but it is sufficiently accurate. The scriptural record insists that the Exodus crossing of the Red Sea happened in the Gulf of Suez, no more than 90 miles from Ramses. Modern maps show that the distance from the ancient site of Ramses to the westernmost gulf of the Gulf of Suez was barely 90 miles. And to the topmost point, it was only 70 miles. But since the wall ran down to Heliopolis, they couldn't have gone to the topmost point of it. They would have had to go somewhat further, a little further south on the Gulf of Suez. In any event, they went around that portion of the wall, they crossed the Gulf of Suez, and ended up in Sinai, right near Shur, where the other side of the wall was located.